That was one of Haydn's Derbyshire Marches, and this is your imperiously genial host, John Derbyshire, with another edition of Radio Derb, brought to you from National Review's lavishly equipped state-of-the-art sound studio here on the 95th floor of Buckley Towers in the heart of Manhattan. My ever-diligent research assistants, Mandy, Candy and Brandy, have performed their lucubrations. The sound engineers are at their stations, and the producer is giving me hand signals through the glass wall here. I do wish he wouldn't, especially that one. So, off we go with news from far and wide. The President gave a short speech announcing a drawdown of our troops from Afghanistan. 10,000 by the end of the year, another 23,000 by next summer. That will still leave 68,000 in place going into the 2012 elections, as the number of troops we have in Afghanistan is currently over 100,000. So we shall still be in Afghanistan in a very big way, a year and more from now. Afghanistan already qualifies as the longest war in our nation's history. You can get an argument on this as the definitions are fuzzy, but the Vietnam War, as an American war, is conventionally measured from the Gulf of Tonkin Resolution in August 1964 to the withdrawal of the last US combat forces in April 1973. That's 104 months. Our war in Afghanistan crossed that mark back in June last year. By next year's election, it'll have been 133 months. That's longer than the Vietnam War, even if you count it to the fall of Saigon. And we'll still have 68,000 troops over there. This is truly the forever war. Now, there are some quibbles you can enter there. It wasn't actually much of a war until the Obama surge in 2009. Troop levels in the Bush years, I think, never exceeded 34,000, one-third of today's number. Still, it's been a major national effort. 10 years, 1,600 American dead, close to $500 billion. That's $3,000 for every working American. In the beginning, Afghanistan was a punitive expedition, fully justified, since the government of that country had offered friendly hospitality to a group that planned the 9/11 attacks on us. With 10,000 troops, we took down that government, chased them into the backcountry, killed a lot of them, and broke their stuff. Mission accomplished. If we had left at that point, the Taliban would soon have come back, but with a new attitude to harbouring America's enemies. Or if not, another six-month campaign, another 10,000 guys, lather, rinse, repeat, until they got the message. Instead, we got those 10 years, those $500 billion, those 1,600 lives. What a stupid waste. In Robert Southey's poem, The Battle of Blenheim, old Caspar is telling his grandchildren, Wilhelmine and Peterkin, about that great engagement. Here are the last two stanzas. Great praise the Duke of Marlborough won, and our good Prince Eugene. Why, 'twas a very wicked thing, said little Wilhelmine. Nay, nay, my little girl, quoth he, it was a famous victory, and everybody praised the Duke who this great fight did win. But what good came of it at last? Quoth little Peterkin. Why, that I cannot tell, said he, but 'twas a famous victory. After last week's Radio Derbs special on the New Hampshire Republican presidential hopeful's dog and pony show, listeners emailed in to grumble that I hadn't given enough coverage to Rick Perry, John Huntsman, and Chris Christie. Well, because they weren't in New Hampshire, that's why. I was covering the debate, and they didn't show for the debate. That simple matter aside, the no-show candidates lose points with me just by being no-shows. You've got to play the game. You've got to walk the long mile to next year's convention. Lurking around in the background, playing some long game, waiting until some strategic point to get yourself in the campaign, well, maybe it has a certain logic to it, and maybe it even sometimes works. But I have more respect for a candidate who's in there mixing it up with other candidates from the start. It shows guts, determination, and energy, and it gives us a good look at the candidate. Having said that, what's going on with these guys? Well, John Huntsman definitely declared this week. He immediately came under fire from Conservatives for his positions on the stimulus, climate change, the Dream Act, spending, and social issues. The immigration restrictionist group Numbers USA scores Huntsman a D- on immigration. There's also, of course, the matter of his having taken an ambassadorial position from the Obama administration. Just for once, I'm going to join the pack here. Huntsman doesn't cut it. John McCain without the heroism, quipped Byron York, and added the following killer observation, quote, "If Huntsman has one solid constituency, it's the press." McCain once semi-jokingly referred to reporters as his base, and Huntsman seems to be moving into a similar spot, enjoying mostly positive treatment from publications like The New York Times and The New Yorker. End quote. Well, every Republican field has to have a rhino candidate. It looks like Huntsman is the rhino for this election cycle. Not even his fellow Mormons are happy with him. Huntsman has in fact been called a mino. That's a Mormon in name only. "I can't say I'm overly religious," he told Fortune magazine last year. "I get satisfaction from many different types of religions and philosophies." End quote. In other words, he's just another mushy elite Unitarian. It's nothing to me. Heck, I'm even less religious than that. But it's a double handicap with Republican voters, one subset of whom won't vote for a Mormon, even if he's a mino, and another subset who wants someone with definite, clear religious beliefs. All in all, Huntsman looks like a no-hoper. Rick Perry hasn't announced, but he's been showing a lot of ankle, and there's a general presumption that he'll run. He has a good, sturdy conservative record, strong on the Tenth Amendment, very strong, in fact, to the point of having spoken favourably of secession. Good on spending, good on guns, a real athlete with the veto pen, I like that, and solid on social issues. He's shucked and jived somewhat on immigration, but this is Texas, and a governor can only do so much. I'll cut him slack there. Overall, a strong and attractive candidate. But you got to get in there, Governor. It's later than you think. Chris Christie I love for his style, sort of Rudy Giuliani with attitude. But when the Republican base nationwide gets a look at his positions on guns and immigration, they'll be mailing their checks to Rick Perry instead. A decent guy and a good governor, but wrong for the presidency. There now. With last week's coverage of the New Hampshire debate, I think I've encompassed all the GOP hopefuls, haven't I? Anyone left out? Sorry? Sarah who? All right, no offence to the lady, whom I like and respect, but I don't believe she'll run, and nor does anyone else I know. The U.S. Supreme Court declined to allow a class action lawsuit against Walmart stores by women employees claiming discrimination. Six employees had originally sued 10 years ago on their own behalf, then later moved for a class action suit on behalf of all women who'd worked for Walmart in the USA since 1998, a group believed to number 1.5 million. SCOTUS unanimously agreed that the women did not meet the criterion for a class action, though the court divided on the usual conservative-liberal lines over whether there was evidence of discrimination. I'm way over in the reactionary camp on all the issues here. First off, I can't understand why class action lawsuits are allowed. If someone's done you a wrong, sue for damages. What entitles you to claim you're representing 1.5 million people? Shouldn't the court have to cross-examine each of the 1.5 million individually? The alternative is to rely on statistics. If you live by statistics, though, you'd better be ready to die by statistics. Here's a fact, a statistical fact, with, of course, many exceptions, as is always the case with statistical facts. Here it is. Men are more aggressive, more driven, more ambitious than women. We know this is so, and we even know why it's so. It's so because men have higher levels of testosterone. It's true. It's a fact. A statistical fact, with numerous exceptions. But hey, who started with the statistics? As I said, you live by statistics, be ready to die by statistics. Given that true fact, what should a commercial organisation do if its business needs driven, aggressive, ambitious managers to push up its profits? Well, it should seek out those kinds of people for promotion. If it does so, it will inevitably end up with more males than females in those positions. Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, in her dissenting opinion on the minor point, noted that women hold 70% of Walmart's hourly jobs, but only 33% of management jobs. Leaving aside the fact that this almost precisely mirrors the male-female ratio on the Supreme Court, so what? It's what you'd expect, based on the statistics. Live by 'em, die by 'em. And now, please explain to me again why we allow class action lawsuits, other than so lawyers can make great bundles of money. Do they safeguard some essential aspect of our liberties? In Switzerland, class action lawsuits are against the country's constitution. Yeah, I know the arguments against invoking foreign laws, American exceptionalism and so on. But look, are the Swiss lacking in some freedom or right that we have? Which one? Perhaps this is one aspect of exceptionalism we'd be better off without. Somalia, as I think is pretty well known, is a mess. And not even the political left can claim that this particular mess is our fault. The place has an exceptionally high proportion of crazy homicidal people. If you were to import a lot of Somalis into your country, you would get a share of those lunatics. That, of course, is just what the USA has done, for reasons utterly mysterious to me. Here are the numbers. Prior to 1983, we took in essentially no Somali refugees. In the next 20 years, up to 2003, we took in over 42,000. Then, in 2004 alone, almost 13,000. Then 2005, 2006, over 10,000 each year. And in 2007, another 7,000. After that, numbers dropped way down, for a rather interesting reason. Once in the USA, a refugee can petition to bring in relatives, a spouse, minor children, parents and siblings. There was suspicion that Somalis, and other Africans too, were cheating. Records are poor in those countries, and officials are easily bribed. When a refugee said that Ali was his brother, and produced an affidavit to that effect, we pretty much had to believe him, even though we've known for years that these affidavits can be bought on the streets of Nairobi for a few dollars. Then, in February 2008, the State Department decided to carry out DNA testing on refugees and their claimed relatives. The results were staggering. The level of fraud was 80%. Only 20% of those claiming to be relatives really were. State was so upset, they suspended family reunification programs for several African countries, Somalia the most affected. Those levels of fraudulent misrepresentation also cast some doubt on the claims that all the tens of thousands of Somali refugees we've taken in have been thoroughly vetted by Homeland Security. These doubts are reinforced by the steady trickle of Somali teenagers heading back to their homeland to make jihad. What's our government doing about any of this? What do you think? They're trying to bring in more Somalis. In fact, they're trying to get the family reunification program restarted. Yes, that's the one with 80% fraud levels. The State Department swears that everyone will be DNA tested this time and compared with refugees already here. Given that the previous fraud gave us a huge base, around 36,000, of Somalis who shouldn't be here, and given that, of course, nobody is talking about identifying and deporting them, you've got to think the horse is out of the stable. And this is not to mention the flow of Somalis coming in across the Mexican border. The going rate is about $10,000 to be smuggled from Somalia to Mexico. That's according to the Minneapolis Star Tribune, which tells us that, quote, one Los Angeles law officer interviewed 200 Somalis smuggled into the United States in 2010 alone. End quote. I'm sure a lot of Somalis are nice people. Given the level of craziness in that country, though, and the appalling record of fraud in the refugee resettlement programs, and the smuggling and the constant reports of teen Somalis being recruited back into terrorist gangs, why would we permit any further settlement from Somalia? Can we please stop being the suckers of the world? Reading the news stories about congressional negotiations on the debt limit, I see in my mind's eye the Roadrunner going off the cliff, running in place in midair until gravity kicks in. The latest news here is the breakdown of the bipartisan talks on a deal, when Representative Eric Cantor and Senator John Kyle pulled out. The talks had been chaired by Vice President Joe Biden. The dynamic had been the familiar one, where Democrats demand tax increases while Republicans demand spending reductions. To be fair, the Democrats, though they were certainly pushing hard for new taxes, did concede some spending cuts. Quote from the Wall Street Journal, quote, Mr. Cantor said the group had identified more than $2 trillion in spending cuts over the next 10 years. However, a Democratic official close to the talks said the total was only about $1.2 trillion, end quote. That is a joke. $2 trillion in 10 years? That's one-fifth of a trillion a year, in an environment of debts and unfunded liabilities in the tens of trillions. It's all so unreal. Mom and Dad are sitting at the kitchen table, arguing about whether to buy new drapes for the bedroom or new light fixtures for the living room, while the bailiffs are banging on the door to repossess the house. When gravity kicks in at last, it's going to be a long drop, with an almighty splatter at the end of it. I guess the interesting political question is whether the big splatter comes before November 2012 or after. If it comes before, I hope Barack and Michelle have suitcases packed and plane tickets ready. If it comes after, we just have to hope that whoever wins next November's election has some serious experience with whitewater rafting. Here's early medieval English history the way I learned it in school. No guarantees of accuracy here, and all allowances made for fading memory. Once England was all British, which is to say Celtic. Then the Romans showed up. They defeated the British kings and Queen Boadicea, and we were part of their empire for 400 years. Then the empire crumbled, the legions withdrew, and the poor old British, who'd been so used to Roman protection they'd forgotten how to fight, they fell prey to savage raiders from Ireland, which at that point was actually Scotland, and also from Scotland, at that point actually Pictland. Just at that moment, foolish King Vortigern recruited German warriors from North Europe as mercenaries to help him deal with the filthy heathen Scots, who lived in Ireland, and the Picts, who lived in Scotland. Two brothers, Hengist and Horsa, came over with three boatloads of bold lads. Once they saw the weakness of the British and the beauty of the land, however, they demanded an increase in their contracting fee. The inevitable ugly quarrel broke out. The Germans called for reinforcement from the tribes back home, who were called Angles, Saxons, and Jutes. And when the dust settled 100 years later, lowland Britain had become Angleland, and the poor old British had been chased off into the mountains, where they became the Welsh, which is just the old Germanic catch-all word for not Germanic. The details have all been lost, though, as nobody much was bothering to write it down. We particularly didn't know much about the numbers of Germans who came over. There must have been quite a lot to defeat the British, who presumably had been multiplying steadily across 400 years of Pax Romana. But then, what ratio of axe-swinging heathen blonde beasts to meek, sedentary, Romanized Christian peasants do you need for subjugation? And we know the British weren't all chased out. There was a lot of coexistence. There's a street in the city of London, just up there by the Bank of England, called Walbrook. That means Welsh Brook. There used to be a little stream there that divided the British part of London from the English part. Well, nowadays we look to the geneticists for answers to this kind of question. This week, they came up with a doozy. Quote, biologists at University College in London studied a segment of the Y chromosome that appears in almost all Danish and Northern German men, and they found it surprisingly common in Great Britain. End quote. Working from the other end, archaeologists digging up old burial places have found an unexpected abundance of Germanic pots and trinkets. Bottom line, the number of Germans who came over was much bigger than previously thought, perhaps 250,000. Put it another way, the English are more German than they had supposed. Well, great movements of people will do that. Here's a related news item. In the year to March 2011, the number of foreigners granted settlement rights in the UK was 586,000. That's more than twice as many in just one year as the entire number for the 5th century, the ones who replaced Celtic Britain with Germanic England. Base populations were lower then, of course, but it's still one year versus several decades. Also, of the 400,000 jobs created in Britain in that same one year, 80% went to foreigners. And here is New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg, an open borders fanatic, telling a symposium at the Council on Foreign Relations June 15th that restrictions on immigration amount to, quote, national suicide, and that is, quote, no hyperbole. Bloomberg's speech is worth reading in full as an exceptionally clear specimen of elite class contempt for American citizens. Boy, how they hate us. Quote, immigrants and their children have been responsible for creating millions more jobs in all 50 states. The reason is simple. Immigrants are dreamers and risk takers who are driven to succeed because they know that in America, hard work and talent are rewarded like nowhere else. End quote. What about the hard work and talent of, you know, Americans, Mr. Mayor? If immigrants are, quote, dreamers and risk-takers who are driven to succeed, what are the rest of us? Chop liver? Dull-witted couch potatoes driven to fail? That is undoubtedly what Bloomberg believes. If the USA has nothing to work with but the slack habits and thin talent of her citizens, we're doomed. National suicide, says the mayor. And he's not being hyperbolic, he assures us. With the misery index, that's unemployment and inflation, at its highest since 1983, what the country needs is more foreigners, says the mayor. He doesn't quite suggest that US citizens should all be killed off or shipped to reservations, but you can see the thought lurking in his mind. Here is the xenophilia of our ruling classes on full display, brazen and unashamed. As a matter of fact, Mr. Mayor, history does offer a few examples of actual national suicide, literal and actual, no hyperbole. There was, for example, the national suicide of Romano-Celtic Britain 15 centuries ago. A few other cases of national suicide also come to mind. Here's a funny thing, though. In none of those cases does the refusal to open up the country to massive foreign settlement seem to have played much of a part. Rather the contrary. Here's a little snippet from the June 24th issue of Nordstjernan, which bills itself as the newspaper for Swedish America. And note, please, my masterly self-restraint in not putting on the sing-song intonations that presenters customarily lapse into when introducing Swedish items. Radio Derb is a class act. You're welcome. All right, here's the quote from Nord Stjernan. Quote, Sweden is one nation in which corporal and also psychological punishment of children is prohibited by law. Of the 24 countries with corporal punishment bans, 19 are in Europe, including all of the Scandinavian and near Scandinavian countries, Sweden, Norway, Denmark, Iceland, and Finland. Three others are in Central or South America, one in the Middle East, and one in Oceania. Although 24 nations have banned corporal punishment, this is only 12% of the world's countries. There are no national bans on corporal punishment anywhere in Asia or North America. End quote. And if you're curious, the Middle East nation that's banned corporal punishment is Tunisia, and the Oceania nation is New Zealand. Sweden was the first nation to ban spanking in the home back in 1979. I bring up this topic in relation to a recent court decision in Corpus Christi, Texas. The court sentenced Rosina Gonzalez to 5 months probation for spanking her child. A couple of things to be noted about this particular case before we proceed. One, the child was not quite 2 years old. Two, the spanking left red marks on the child's bottom. So this was a very young child, and it was some spanking. My default position on all such cases is that of a parent's rights near absolutist. I'd like the civil powers to go to the extremes of caution in interfering between parents and kids. I'm not naive about this. I know the things that sometimes happen. I once worked as a teacher in a school in one of England's worst slums. If the parent is stubbing out cigarettes in the kid's face, I want the parent locked up. And yes, stuff like that happens. This side of cigarette burns and broken bones, though, pretty much the cruelest thing you can do to a small child is to take it away from the home and the parents that it knows. I've seen that happen too, and it was utterly heartbreaking, even though the parents in the case fell far short of middle-class child-raising standards. Well, the judge in the Corpus Christi case told the mother, quote, "You don't spank children today. In the old days, maybe we got spanked, but there was a different quarrel. You don't spank children." End quote. It seems to me that judge is out of line. It may indeed be that our standards have shifted so much that the generality of citizens would like spanking to be banned. If that's the case, let them press their representatives to pass appropriate legislation. The current situation in the US is that spanking in the home is legal in every state. 19 states, Texas among them, also permit spanking in schools. This judge, his name is Jose Longoria, is therefore legislating from the bench, a far more serious offence against public standards, in my opinion, than smacking a 2-year-old on the rear end. Going back to the Nord Stjernan article, though, here's the thing I'm curious about. Looking forward at the future of the USA in the rest of this century, the USA my children and grandchildren will inherit, it seems to me that we shall slide from being an eccentric but still distinctively North European outpost in the New World with a small African minority to being a much more Latin American kind of society. That is, a small, wealthy, pale-skinned elite living in big houses on the tops of the hills, and a huge, multiracial, lumpen proletariat living disorderly lives in smelly slums. And the great American middle class, a fading memory. That seems to me our likely future. A kind of scaled-up version of Guatemala. But then, in so many social matters, we seem to be trending in the direction of Scandinavia, with rampant feminism and the general wussification that goes with it. The system you might call bossy egalitarianism. So, what do we want to be? Guatemala or Sweden? Answers on a postcard, please. My own choice would have been to remain what we were 50 years ago. A straight-laced, mildly snobbish Anglo-democracy with easy access for everyone to a comfortable middle-class lifestyle. That's lost and gone, though, and it won't come back. It's Guatemala or Sweden. Take your pick. And now, our closing miscellany of brief items. Item. If you want to know why our republic is so deeply, hopelessly in debt, there are about 10,000 directions I could send you in for an answer. Here's just one. It's a column this week by Michael Barone. Michael is a thoughtful Beltway conservative. A bit wonkish for my taste, but a decent, well-read guy with his heart mostly in the right place. Well, he wrote a column this week. Topic, a federal crackdown on sex jokes on the nation's college campuses. No kidding. Tell a classmate that one about the flea in Omar Sharif's mustache, and you'll be looking at 2-5 in Leavenworth. This comes from an initiative by the Federal Department of Education Office of Civil Rights, in the form of a 19-page letter to all the colleges and universities in the country, demanding more energetic investigation of sexual harassment charges, including, quote, humor and jokes about sex in general that make someone feel uncomfortable. So, not only do we have a Federal Department of Education doing nothing useful at all, that department also has an Office of Civil Rights. As if anyone in the USA is suffering from a lack of civil rights. Although, if our civil rights include the right to tell off-colour jokes to co-eds, as I should have thought they do, we shall henceforth be suffering from a lack of that particular one. Your tax dollars at work, and I will guarantee you with utter certainty that in none of the cost-cutting measures being contemplated in Congress has anyone mentioned abolishing the Department of Education Office of Civil Rights, let alone the department itself. Our ruling classes would see us all eating grass before they'd abolish a federal department. Even one that does nothing but mischief. Item. Geert Wilders, the off-puttingly blonde Dutch politician, has been acquitted in his trial for inciting hatred of Muslims. Said the trial judge, I'm quoting here from Reuters, quote, the presiding judge said Wilders' remarks were sometimes hurtful, shocking, or offensive, but that they were made in the context of a public debate about multiculturalism, and therefore not a criminal act. End quote. That's a good result, and another encouraging sign that Europeans are turning against multiculturalism. I don't agree with Wilders about Islam, which he obviously detests. I don't detest it. I don't even mind it much, but I'll allow it's going through an ugly phase right now, as religions do from time to time. and it doesn't play nicely with other cultural traditions. Let's keep Islam confined to its homelands and stop mass immigration of Muslims into Western countries. Not with the ill will that Geert Wilders displays, but just because multiculturalism is a crock. The Netherlands, Britain, France, Italy, the USA have all the cultures they need. We don't need any more, thanks all the same. And no offence. Item. News here from the Middle East, everyone's favourite region. Let's see, what's the news? Something or other transpired in Syria. Around the same time, stuff happened in Libya. And meanwhile, some kind of unpleasantness was going down in Yemen, wherever the hell that is. It was all real interesting and terrifically important, so I'm told. Item. Oh, just a follow-up on the Geert Wilders acquittal here. Following the court ruling, Muslims in the Netherlands have said they will now take the case to the United Nations Human Rights Council. Here, just to refresh your memory, are a few of the members of the 47-nation Human Rights Council. Cameroon, China, Cuba, Guatemala, Kyrgyzstan, Mexico, Nigeria, Moldova, Russia, Saudi Arabia, Senegal, Uganda. Well, let's hope the appeal is successful. Who knows? Perhaps one day the people of the Netherlands, currently groaning under the iron heel of monoculturalist oppression, perhaps one day they'll enjoy as full human rights as the blessed citizens of Cuba, Russia, and Saudi Arabia. We live in hope. And there you have it, ladies and gentlemen. Please rest assured that the omission of a news item does not mean any lack of concern on the part of us here at Radio Derb. Our time is limited and we must be severely selective. I was, for example, just as distressed as the rest of you on learning that Amina, the Syrian lesbian blogger, was in fact a 40-year-old married American guy named Tom McMaster, while the deaf lesbian mom running another blog called Les Get Real is in fact Bill Graeber, a 55-year-old retired construction worker in Ohio. It all goes to prove that we middle-aged heterosexual white guys make the world go round. The rest of you are just along for the ride. And following on from that, I should add that my researchers have been able to find no substance to the rumours that gay blogger Andrew Sullivan is in fact a 62-year-old Amish with 8 kids living in Lancaster, Pennsylvania. No evidence for that at all, sorry. Although we'll keep digging.